you're playing slow, so we're playing through. Hosted by Bob Ballew and Carl Mickelson. Brought to you by the PGA Tour Superstore.
Good Saturday morning to you, Austin, Texas, and welcome inside another edition of Playing Through right here on the Horn. Live from UT Golf Club. Carl, we got a special one this morning, don't we?
We are coming at you live. There's nothing like it, is there, Bob?
There's not. I'm Bob Ballew. He is Carl Mickelson. This is a real treat. We are, as I said, live at UT Golf Club, and we are starting a project that features golf courses around the Austin area. And where better place to start than this, right?
Perfect question. What better place to start? This University of Texas Golf Club is right at two decades, but it oozes so much more history, right? I mean, you can feel the decades, the legacy, all the way back to Harvey Pinnick and, you know, Coach Hannon, and every the hallways, the fairways, the golf carts, everything about this place just emanates the rich history of the University of Texas and the legacy of golf here. So it's a perfect place to start.
Yeah, and we had a chance to come out here last week. I hope you had a chance to listen to the show. We talked to – I'm going to mess up his title because we talked about his title.
I know.
General Manager and COO.
You nailed it.
Of UT Golf Club, Steve Tremere. And I, if you didn't get a chance to listen last week, please go back and listen on the on SoundCloud on our podcast area, because Steve took us, in depth about what this golf club is, what it means to people, the Longhorn legacy to it. He always has so many great stories as it is, but really special last week to get to visit for so long with Steve about what this place means to so many people.
It really was. I mean, you can see Steve's passion. You can see why he's in that driver's seat for this place. It just really, not only is he an alum, does he have a legacy of playing for the university, but he puts his heart and soul into this place, and so much of the culture just emanates from Steve and his passion and his team that he's built. I mean, you just look at the golf staff here and how long so many people have been here and a part of this place, and it's special. It shows every time you come, it's special here.
And I think if you know anyone that's a member out at UT Golf Club, or you know anyone that is a part of this place or has played out here, you get that feeling. You get that sense of what this place means. So what better time to bring in one of the people who really understands UT Golf Club, golf in Austin, the history of what golf in Austin is, plus where it's going. And we are really honored this morning to welcome in the three-time All-American at the University of Texas and seven-time winner on the PGA Tour, Mark Brooks. Mark, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you, guys. Thank you for having me. We're out here on the back porch with the fire going, and it is nice. I've been fortunate to be, have two good friends that actually, basically started this club. So a couple of Dallas guys that spend way too much time here in Austin, and Bill Duvall and Mike Myers. So, from the very beginning, and it's gotten nothing but better as it's gone forward. And, y'all, of course, you mentioned Steve and Greg, the head golf professional, yeah. Greg Garner. I mean, they've been here since the beginning, and that's pretty rare. That'd be like having the same Baptist minister at a church for about 30 years.
So you're exactly right.
That doesn't happen.
I want to know something, though, Mark. You see, they've got this great complex for the men's and women's golf teams. Tell us about the contrast of what it was like in the early 80s for you to be – you mentioned three-time All-American, so we're not talking about chops. We're not talking about, working out of a trailer. But talk about the courses you played and what was different about what these players have, the Jordan Spieths and Scottie Schefflers and the kids coming through now, what they had is maybe didn't have.
Well, I don't know if I'd look at it as what we didn't have. Mm-hmm. It was definitely different. I was thinking about it earlier, you're talking about golf equipment, how much has it changed, mm-hmm. In the decades now, unfortunately. But, I remember getting my golf – I wanted to try leather grips. I mean, I went to Golfsmith. It was a little tiny, probably 500-square-foot shack, and bought the underlistings and the leather and spent, $100 back then to do it. We didn't get fit back then. Okay, we got – pretty much we got whatever equipment we could get our hands on, and we learned how to use it. I'm not so sure that's not a good thing in a lot of ways.
Yeah, right.
I mean, I think you created some funky golf swings, but we didn't have as many excuses back then. This driver, it's too open, it's too closed, it doesn't spin enough, it's, the loft's wrong. My shaft, I need to go to the Venice red instead of this blue or the black color. I'm like, man, we had a couple of shafts to choose from, stiff or extra stiff, okay?
Right.
And you went out and learned how to play with them. There's a lot to be said about that. You know, your wedge, you just learned how to play a wedge. If it had too much bounce, you either stuck it out of your car, you opened your door, and you drug it down I-35, and you took some bounce off, okay? I mean, it really was like that. And so I think, learning to be more creative was probably a good thing. So I just wanted to bring that, put that out
point.
There. It's a totally different world. No, I'm all for fitting. I mean, to be honest, but there's a point where we go a little overboard. I mean, you get a new set of irons and you go out and hit them pretty good on the range, and you hit them okay the first four or five holes. And you hit a bad six iron on the sixth hole. This is the wrong set.
You want to go straight to the fitter.
Yeah, absolutely.
Amateurs even want to go straight to the fitter.
This is the wrong set. Yeah. So it's pretty interesting. But no, I played, and even in Fort Worth, I played a ton of public golf. I mean, I grew up at Diamond Oaks over on the northeast side of town. We had they'll forgive me now because most of them are gone, but, you know, we had a lot of degenerate golfers over there, degenerate gamblers, I might add.
And another good way to learn the game, right?
Could be, yeah. without over-encouraging it, if you can afford it. But, yeah, there was something on the line. I mean, if we were down there just chipping around, every time, you know, not every single shot every day, but a lot of shots there was something on the line. So we kind of learned that, you know, every shot counts. to use a phrase, but you playing public golf, you know, I mean, you know, really muni golf, which we played a lot in Fort Worth, Meadowbrook, Rockwood, Zevos. I mean, just start naming them. Then down here, we played them all from, you know, Lions, was Jimmy Clay back in the day. Mm-hmm. You know, some of the golf courses weren't even here, obviously, back then. But you definitely learned how to play some pretty good golf under a little tougher conditions. Not pristine lies all the time. You missed a green, it was random, whatever lie you had. So you either, you know, bished and complained and griped about it and shot 75, or you figure out how to get it up there, you know, get it up and down. So there's a lot to be said for that, where, I mean, I played the tour a long time. So I certainly was one of the guys that fell under spoiled to the great conditions guys, and no doubt about it. So, but I think a little rougher beginning was probably very good for a lot of us back in the day.
I'm just really glad the degenerate gambling stopped. That's a really good thing. We're past that era.
Well, if you wait till the sun comes up, there'll be some guys pulling in the parking lot in a little while. So,
what? Just on the UT Golf Club front, what does this place mean to you?
I mean, a ton. Everything.
Yeah.
Obviously, I came straight out of high school here. I went straight from UT to the tour. I was pretty lucky. I didn't have to play any other tours. I got my card the first fall after I'd finished playing college golf. So I learned how to play on the PGA Tour and didn't have to go through, you know, go to Europe or Asia or anyplace else. So that was fortunate for me. But as far as here, it's just the loyalty that's, you know, exudes from this place for people that, you know, gave some of their time and energy and life to the university. It's paid back tenfold here.
Yeah.
And I know you see that at other places. There's no question.
Sure.
We're not unique to that.
The best part of Austin golf probably is that it happens all over Austin. There are a lot of places.
No question.
Yeah.
I mean, Barton Creek, that wasn't here. I mean, you know, Austin Country Club was across, you know, Riverside. So it's changed and changed for the better. And like you said, 20 years, this place is only basically 20 years old. So anyway, it's when the Hills opened, I'll back you up. When the Hills opened, I bought
81, right?
It was the spring of 81 when we got to kind of go out there. I mean, that was a life, you know, that was a eye opener. And for me, it wasn't that I had let's just call it a little more high end place to be welcomed. That was nice.
Mm-hmm.
What changed out there, which we still have today here, but Chuck Cook, Dave Pels, Mike Adams, Bucky Ayers was the original head pro, welcomed us with open arms. But they had an academy out there that Chuck ran, you know, was started. And all of a sudden there were, I want to say Dr. Coop, the well-known sports psychologist, you know, Chuck built this team. And it took him a couple of years, but we were, you know, get to see the front end of that. So we had a place, and no knock on Coach Hannon, but he ran two golf courses. He was the head golf professional. And then trying to keep up with us, but we had a source and a place to go if you were having problems with your game that was beyond competent. And we didn't have to go hunt it down.
I think Austin was very underrated. I mean, they talk about Southern Florida and Palm Springs, but I think Austin in that era was a mecca for great minds in golf, right?
Bill Moretti, Mike Adams. I mean, you could just keep going on. The guys,
pretty amazing.
Fred Griffin. Mm-hmm. I mean, I could just keep naming names that came through here. And Chuck has a lot to do with that. I mean, Chuck's out here now. Chuck Cook, the, you know, world-renowned teacher and storyteller. But, you know, he beyond wealth of knowledge. But that was the first time, other than your club pro, are the really good players, because I'm fortunate. I grew up around a lot of good players. Texas Wesleyan, who won, I don't know how many, 25 NAIs or some crazy deal. O.D. Bounds was the golf coach there for years. They used Diamond Oaks, where I grew up, as one of their home courses.
Oh, wow.
And North Texas would come down. It was only 25 minutes from North Texas. So besides our degenerate golfers that were all probably about plus one, plus two, plus three guys and carried about five handicaps, I was exposed to a lot of really good, you know, college golf guys that were, I'm going to say, 5 to 7 years older than I was, you know, when I was going through those teen years. So, I mean, we got to play with guys that were really, really, really good. So that was a huge advantage to see how the game kind of was supposed to be played, if that makes sense.
It does, yeah. And your era overlaps. I mean, you're talking about your generation in college golf and you guys breaking on tour overlaps with Fred Couples, the Billy Ray Browns of the world. I'm leaving
sure.
off a ton, but yeah.
It's Hal Sutton.
Steve Elkington. Yeah, just an incredible era of guys. Talk about that evolution. We'd be remiss if we didn't point out that you've played more PGA Tour events than anybody. You're the Cal Ripken or the Tom Brady or however you want to phrase
I wouldn't go there.
Well, in terms of longevity, 803 tour events, that's hard to fathom. It's hard to even crunch the numbers at how much of a warrior
you're
out there.
It's easy.
Okay.
It's 25 a year for 32 years.
32 years
then
on
you
the
need
PGA
to play,
Tour.
Then you got to play four more. So
there you go.
You won't get there.
That's
the math.
Do you think that's something that anybody will do now that we feel like we're in this era of just – How few events can I play and make as much money as I can?
Well, that was
and
the
then,
nexus of the whole live thing, is
right.
They want to play less. They're
right.
Not going to play as much as Mark played.
I think with the, you know, it's not just the purse sizes, but although that plays a huge role, the amount of money they can make in a shorter window. Well, I'll back up. I'll put it in perspective. My rookie year, and I won't be exact, so I'll round it off. It's within $1,000, $30,000 kept your card my rookie year. That was top 125.
Wow.
And it might have been a little under because they used to pull the foreigner, the Nick Faldos and like Bernhard Langer. Some of those guys would come over and play, you know, eight or nine events.
Right.
They would
right.
take them off the list. Right. So it would always float down to, you know, usually 131, 132 would get their card. I'm not so sure it wasn't like 28,000. I mean, it's hard to even fathom
right.
now.
Right.
So when Pete guys say, well, what was the money like back then? You say, well, you could double your earnings off course. I go, yeah, it was easy when you were making about 40 grand. You know, you'd have three deals that were about 10,000 a piece and you doubled your money. And you go chase around the Monday outings and they'd pay, you know, the big deal was if they paid you cash, you know,
yeah.
It was like 750 cash. That was a good Monday, $750 cash or $1,000 cash. So, yes, the times have changed. They don't need to play as much. I'm going to say, you know, definitely they've gone more into the gym, which, you know, I'm not knocking. I think it's great. I mean, maybe some guys overdo it. And when I say that, they overdo it from a time standpoint. Mm-hmm. This guy that can't, you know, make a five-footer, why is he in the gym for 3 hours? I'm like, dude, switch it around. How about an hour in the gym and 3 hours on the putting green instead of 3 hours in the gym, an hour on the putting green? I know because it's more painful to go try to learn how to putt, but so there may be some time management, but I think the fitness part has taken more of their time, you know, to get sore. So they want to take 2 weeks off now, you know, and they want to maybe do a lot of working out that first week, do a lot of recovery, not much golf. Then the next week they start pulling the golf back.
And they have the luxury of doing it. You know, I mean, they're not trying to make $30,000 to make – I mean, they're making $750,000. And then they're like, I can take whatever.
I mean, the money escalated.
Yeah,
and,
sure.
Which is great, but I mean, I'll be wrong, but I know quite a few stats that are within a year or two. You know, Curtis Strange first got to win $1 million. You know,
right.
Prize money for the year, like 1988 or something, 89.
Yep.
And he probably won. I think he won four or five times, including U.S. Open. So You know, the first couple of his first tournaments, Vegas, finally played for $1 million. That was around 1990. I mean, so the money been going up, but it's a new world out there, and we got you know, there's a new tour that's been started, and
I was going to ask, are you excited for the semifinals today? I'm sure, I know it's got to be on the front of your mind, right?
I'm going to go watch TCU West Virginia at 11. you got don't overlap there though. I mean, there's some benefit to, you know, as a lot of guys have said, and I'll echo along. There is some benefit to competition, no doubt about it. And how would you say this? The tour was, I'm going to say it was time for some significant changes.
Wake up call.
Yeah.
Changes in how it operates. Now, I'm not talking about PIP and all that, you know, the guarantee money, but there were definitely some changes that need to happen.
And that's okay. Like, it's not this, like Carl and I, mean, we've talked for months now about this, but it doesn't have to be one or the other, or, I mean, like everything in life, right? Like in politics and in, I mean, everything. Like, it doesn't have to be black and white. Like, we can have discussions about what needs to change and how it needs to change, right?
I agree. I mean, it's funny to me. I use the phrase, you know, be careful what you wish for. So the tour has fought tooth and nail for the last, you know, almost since their existence, 40 years, from allowing the players to formally, I'm going to call it organize.
Right.
Stop short of a union. But, you know, when somebody says how bad, you know, the unions are in professional sports, I'm just going to say, man, you need to do a little more research. Okay? You know, the benefits that they've gotten as players – negotiating with the owners, and I know it's a totally different business structure, the tour versus those other leagues, but if you could argue, you can't argue for one second that the players haven't benefited. I mean, it's like they're in a different universe now from where they were even 20 years ago. Sure. You go back and look at what Tom Brady was making when he started. And, you know, so they fought for an equal share of the revenue. I mean, cut it short, that's what it is. You know, people don't understand what the sports union is all about. It's not about all greed, you know, to be honest with you. They do go to the table. They have their own representation. And the owners, they all have their own agenda when they go to the table. That's what negotiating is about. And you finally find a compromise. I can't live without you, and you can't live without me. Let's sit down at the table and figure this out. Yep. There was too much secrecy, meaning not really open about what is going on down here. And, you know, these guys have been on the policy board. You know, they say, well, I've seen the books. Rory famously quoted, you know, I've seen the books. To be real honest with you, you've seen the books. You've seen the numbers they showed you.
That's right.
Obviously, you know, when he went on, he was chirping. If you can go back and start pulling up old interviews, wouldn't be a nice montage, because it's like, I've seen the books and everything's great. And, like, all of a sudden, hundreds of millions of dollars, you know, has been found.
Maybe more.
Or reallocated.
Right.
And
right.
So my point is, you know, what did it take? It took a lot of pressure.
Right.
And all of a sudden, they coughed, and they found it. And so I think it'll end up being a better place.
And as Carl and I have talked a whole lot about, Phil Mickelson is going to be the guy that will go down as the – but he did
– he raised all the right points.
He brought up a lot of points that significantly changed things. And not that – maybe he went about it the wrong way. Maybe he – you know, there are people who are always going to look at it different ways, but – he did do he made a significant move in this movement.
He did. And I'll just, maybe you end with this. Phil Phil may get the credit, but there's been a significant group over the years that have been picking at that scab.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
There've been a whole bunch of guys been picking at that scab.
Yes.
And, you know, let's just say finally ripped it off.
Yeah.
So Phil ripped it on off.
Yeah, for sure.
And was not graceful or eloquent.
Nope. That was a big challenge. But shifting gears, Mark,
yes.
we've talked for almost 15 minutes, and we haven't talked about 1996.
Right.
I remember,
well, we don't have to.
I remember interviewing. It's a far cry from the live days and, you know, people hitting it 400 yards. But
hold on, Carl, I'm going to stop you there for 1 second. Can you stick with us for a few minutes?
Yes, sir.
Okay, we need to take a quick break. We just hit that point, so I want to
fair
take
enough.
A quick break, and then we'll
look at that.
We'll, I know. It goes quick. But we're going to take a quick break. Mark Brooks joining us this morning here at UT Golf Club live, and we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back with more from Mark Brooks and that 1996 special year. We'll be back right after this.
little bit, we've settled into the same music for probably a little bit over a year now. So we go Black Angels into Krungbin to, I don't know what closes the show anymore.
We'll find out.
We'll find out, yeah. We don't usually get this benefit.
Yeah, no, right.
It's nice. Nice to be here.
Another good Saturday morning to you, Austin, Texas. Welcome back inside. Another edition of Playing Through here on the Horn. He is Carl Mickelson. I'm Bob Ballou. Joined this morning live at UT Golf Club by Mark Brooks. 803 professional events on the PGA Tour played, a PGA Tour record. But we want to get into what 1996 meant to you, the PGA Championship win. As you reflect on your career, seven PGA Tour wins, a PGA Championship, what does that PGA Championship mean to you as a guy who's done a whole lot in this game?
Well, I don't know if I'd say I've done a whole lot. I've been in the game a long time. Game's given me a lot. I teach a lot now. Not full-time, but I teach, again, everywhere, you know, pretty much all ages. And I try to, you know, stick to people that, you know, kind of serious about it.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean they're tour guys. I mean, just I'm talking about serious about golf, love golf. If you love golf and you're kind of serious about getting a little bit better, then, you know, I could be your guy. But so I've got a lot of kids. But go back to 96, you know, what does it mean? I mean, it's permanent. It's kind of interesting because I won't refer back, but it's just when you talk about reflecting all these last couple years with all the stuff going on in golf, there has been a lot of reflection. And there's words, you know, legacy and, you know, history and all that. I'm like, look, let me tell you something. Winning a tournament's a big deal for everybody. You know, it's kind of a lot of kids' dream. But when it comes to legacy and history, the majors are the ones that have stuck around. A lot of tournaments are gone.
Right.
I mean, you know, you won. There's a ton of guys that have a PGA Tour win at a place that hadn't. It's been gone for maybe 20 years. So, like, ooh, what? You know, you won a tour event. But as far as, you know, wasn't a, like, that's why guys want to win a Colonial Memorial. They want to win something they know they feel like it's going to be there for a long, long time. Then it's. Like my Houston Open was a big deal for me,
sure.
Which was in 96. You know, to be able to win in your home state, you know, Houston Open, there's another one. I mean, you know, I'm pulling for them all every day, but I mean, they went to the fall. I mean, we got the new fall thing going. You're like, gosh, I mean, you can't even imagine that the Houston Open might be gone after, you know, I don't know how long, 70 years. I mean,
right.
some wild number. And growing up at Colonial, around Colonial, that's one. But the PGA. It's because it's got permanence. You know, it has history goes back to the early 1900s. A lot of people forget. I mean, the Masters, I'd love to have a green jacket. Are you kidding me?
Sure.
But, I mean, it started in the 30s. So the British Open started in 1860s. So, you know, it's got history.
Yeah.
It's got legacy. And so that's kind of the thing. So I'm careful with that, you know, like overdoing the nostalgia. I think that when you think back, reflect back, it was more the process and the journey. You know, when you've had the bad times, what'd you do? You know, because that's what you do with teaching. When you're teaching or when you're a player, when you're healthy and things are going good, everything's going good. It's when you're a teacher, you know, unless it's somebody you know you've stuck with, generally you go hunt. More than half the people that come see you are already sick. You know, you're kind of like the golf doctor. They're not coming to you with their best stuff. They're coming to you, you know, depressed with, you know, problems and, you know, the whole
management issues.
All of it. And they're looking for the quick fix, which, you know, there usually doesn't exist. But anyway, it's very interesting. But so I think back, and that's how I help a lot of these kids. Cause, you know, I tell them all the time. I said, look, the only reason I think I'm a pretty competent teacher and coach is because I learned a boatload of ways of how to do it wrong. You know, where I'd go down these, you know, proverbial rabbit holes. I was looking for a quick fix, too. You kidding me? You miss six, seven cuts in a row? I mean, it gets bleak. You're looking for that weekend fix, that guru to give you that one thought. You know, turn this over here and put your little left toe, you know, whatever. So we're always looking for that quick fix. And unfortunately, they usually don't come. So that's what I reflect.
I know you like to stay looking ahead, but in 96, do you remember what was clicking? Because you won the Shell Houston Open in the spring.
I won the Hope in January.
The Hope in January. And you were running hot in the summer, too, obviously. Top five at the Open Championship, if I recall.
Well, the Hope was a good story because I was staying with a friend of mine who was the he God bless his soul, he passed away in 2010, but he had a place in Palm Springs that he shared with a man named Billy Kempton, who started Kempton Hotel Chain. And my partner was one of the founders of Williams-Sonoma, Pottery Barn, you know, the whole nine yards. So famous guys, super successful business people. I had not putted well the week before, and I missed the cut at Tucson, drove over. It's only, you know, whatever, 3 or 4 hour drive to Palm Springs. And I'm digging in the garage because they had all these clubs, and they were in a nice club over there. And I took like five or six of their putters out. And sure enough, this one, man, it felt pretty good. And it was Mr. Kempton's, Billy Kempton's putter. Had his tag. I still have it to this day. And I took it out, whatever, Saturday or Sunday, you know, after missing the cut in Tucson. And I'm on the weekend in Palm Springs, and this thing's going. Ended up putting with that putter, and I won that week. So it was pretty – that was a good story. And
well, how long does it stay in the bag?
Oh, probably a month. Okay. You know.
Fickle even back then, right?
But that was 96, and I had – so, you know, if you look back at my record, my best – really consistent play was probably 91, 92. Mm-hmm. And I had a bunch of top 10s in there with no wins, you know, up top 20 money list. When you do that with no wins, you're having 10, 11, 12 top 10s, you've had a good year, honestly, mm-hmm. even sure. if you're playing, you know, 28 to 30 events. You're top 10 in 30% of the time. That's phenomenal for somebody like me. And it didn't last very long, but I'll back you up. My start, how I got better, I mean, I was a good player in college. I was just a good college player. Good amateur, not great, not by any stretch. And I'd played on the tour 4 or 5 years, and I was probably headed to, you know, go do something else. Seriously. And this was the end of 1987.
Okay.
And I went home after squeaking through Q school. Had to go back, you know, 126 to 150 or whatever, and played a really good last final round at Q school. Went from, like, I don't know, outside the cut line by 20, 30 guys to inside by 30. So that's – and which is to this – you know, if you ask
me – we're talking pre-Hogan tour.
This is 1987.
Yeah, so there was no developmental –
there might have been.
It was, but it was
– I wasn't going over there. Yeah. I mean, to be honest with you.
Right.
Just maybe, you know, no.
Oh, yeah, but I knew Tom Siekman. He won 3 times on 3 different continents before he broke through on the tour. I mean, so the options were to, you know, go far-flung places or like you said, look for another career.
Well, I was going to look for another career. And so, in lieu of looking for another career, I went back home, Diamond Oaks, great player, dad, the head pro son, and Doug Higgins Jr., and we had a long, you know, weekend talking about it. This is, I mean, like immediately, within a day or two getting back. And, you know, I'm looking at my, you know, how the shots I could play in my golf swing and what it felt like, and I just said, I'm done. I mean, there's no way I can compete with this. And we ended up going out. I bought an 8mm camera. We set up screens. And it was the first time I actually got to see my golf swing. And it was a pretty, you know, reasonable quality. Like, I don't remember, 8,000 frames per second. It was tight enough we could see what I was doing. But that was the first time I could actually see my golf swing. And so doing that, Doug's knowledge, you know, and he had been teaching some and quite a bit. But a really good, really good, really good player. And I'd grown up with him. And so I had a lot of trust in him. And by me being able to see the changes, I was able to turn, you know, all these feels into stuff that was real. When I could see it, I'm like, ah, really? It doesn't feel like that. Well, no, it doesn't. It never does. Never feels what it really is. That changed. That was the whole deal. If I hadn't had that, I'm going to call it December, January, the end of 87, early 88, you know, it was just luck. I mean, I was finally, again, I was wise enough as a player to understand that what I had wasn't going to get any better.
You know.
Does that make sense? I knew. It was it. This is it. I'm so limited with my shot selection. I'm not going to be able to play what I call, you know, serviceable golf shots at a PGA Tour level. And I made the change. I won that summer in 88. I mean, I was struggle. I credit it to Doug Jr., you know, hard-headed me, finally going, I need real help. This weekend fix, I'd hunted down over those first 4 or 5 years. The weekend to see Jim Flick, the weekend to go look at that guy, go over here. You know, you'd think 2 or 3 days, man, he'll, you know, nah. I mean, for one, you're back at it. You know, you're right back in the saddle. You're lucky if you got a week off when you're chasing your card.
True.
So you're trying to fix it after missing the cut. You're trying to fix it Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. You got 5 days to make major changes and then put it back under the gun. It's real hard. Trust me, it's really difficult. But that changed my golf life. There's zero question. So that final round, I played in 87 Q School. And I played with Kel Devlin, who ended up Bruce Devlin's son, son who played, you know, Bruce is a legend, and he ended up working for Nike because he kids me. He goes, you know, hey, we played together. And he shot 73, and I shot 67 the last day. And he missed because he reminded me 10 years later. I ended up with Nike for a while, you know, playing the ball and stuff. And he's like, you know, that last round, because he remembers it more than I did. He goes,
wow.
You know, I shot 73, and I'm doing this, and you shot 67. You got a major.
That's
and all
that fine line, right?
No question. Done. Zero.
I got to ask this. What would you have done?
What would I have done? Boy, there's no telling. I thought for a while I wanted to get in the restaurant business, but I mean, people have told me, man, that was a good decision to not do that. But no, they're wildly successful. I love to cook. Who knows? Who knows what I'd figure something out.
Incredible. Your first win was the Greater Hartford Open. Sammy Davis's name was on that tournament.
For sure.
Did you get to hang out with him? Was it a?
I would not say hang out. I was not invited into the Rat Pack, but I mean, he was there, and that was the last one he actually did.
Oh, right.
And that one might have had. So I want my claim to fame on wins is I won the Greater Slam. You know, there's the big
Greater
Slam.
Greater Milwaukee.
Yeah.
Greater Hartford.
When one community couldn't quite pull it together, it had to become Greater.
And the Greater Greensboro.
Greater Greensboro.
That was the Slam.
Sure. Grand Slam winner Mark Brooks joined us this morning here on, Playing Through.
That's right.
How often do you go back to Valhalla?
I hadn't been back much.
No?
To be honest with you, no. I know they've changed ownership again.
Right.
So it's back in local hands, and I do know one of the guys. So
was the crowd against you that day? Because Kenny was the guy that – the Kentucky native that everybody wanted to see win.
I mean, this is Saturday. It's football day.
Right.
So if you're not with me, you're against me.
No. Right.
To be honest,
an overwhelming thing. It very rarely is
most of the time. You use the negative energy as a positive.
Yeah,
right. No.
Positive. I mean, you know what I mean. It's just energy, so you can use it any way. I didn't sense it.
Okay.
And to be honest, and I love Kenny Perry, and you know he's still, you know, a really good friend, and you know went back and won the Ryder Cup. I mean, honestly, if you look at his career, it almost spurred him on. I mean, the guy won like 15 times after that, made a gazillion dollars and had a fantastic career. But, you know, I was in the mode, I'll do my thing. And, you know, and so mercifully, the playoff didn't last very long.
Right.
So I didn't have to hear a whole lot of stuff.
Do you remember what you felt getting on the tee for the playoff, for the sudden death playoff? Like, was it confidence, or was it a little bit of nerves, or were you like, let's go win this thing right now?
Well, there's always nerves. And again, remember, I'd won a couple times the year. I was having a good year, so there was no zero financial issue. You know what I mean? You're not, because let's face it, I mean, the money matters.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And at some point, you know, when you're making some decisions out there, whether it's stupid or not, but now, I mean, I can tell you, what was I thinking? I'll assure you, I had one or two simple swing thoughts that I was playing with. That's all I thought about. Focus entirely on executing the shot. Pick the shot. How do I do it? Execute it. 100%. No, I was pretty good at getting myself in the bubble. You know,
yeah.
Most of the time.
You'd have to be.
And so I was in the bubble, and they're out there. What would get you is sometimes, you know, I remember playing a couple times with, you know, different guys. I mean, it could have been Fred Couples or whoever. But when you're going from green to the next tee and the people are so close, a lot of screaming, which, you know, I never played a Ryder Cup, but I'm sure they get it. And it can be almost deafening. I mean, they're literally like, can be a foot from your ear, and they're just screaming at the top of their lungs. So all of a sudden you get on the next tee and you got the ringing going on. You're like, what's going on with me? You know, like, dude, the guy just almost, you know, made you deaf. You know, went DEFCON on your ears. So as far as the crowd, go back to your team sports. You know, I'll give you an example. My first win was at Hartford. No exaggeration. I guarantee you there's over 40,000 people in that bowl coming up 18 at Hartford. I mean, y'all remember the deal. It's,
oh, yeah.
Their crowds, they were just as big then as they are now. And they were just lined. It was like an amphitheater they built there on the 18th hole. You know, famous, a lot of famous, you know, playoffs there. Jordan holding out the bunker shot. You know, a lot of chip-ins. So you learn pretty early on, and it's like all of a sudden it's just a mass of people. It's just like basketball. I mean, if you're in a gym that's full, shooting a free throw, and there is nobody in the gym, and it's real quiet, and there's one clown up there behind, that's distracting.
Right.
But if it's a whole sea, and it's just a, you know, it's just background noise. So, no, it's a great question. But I guarantee you I got in the bubble. No doubt.
That's amazing. You know, you talked about that time in 87 when you're out there searching, you discovered video, and Doug Higgins Jr. kind of helped you discover some of the things. That sounds like the very seed of you becoming a teacher, which you do a lot of now. You do a lot of teaching. Are you the kind of guy that watches a tour event and sees somebody in the struggle and your mind just starts reeling how you would fix them? Are you that guy?
No, I'm not that guy. I more watch what, you know, I'm definitely not that guy. I do study golf swings, no doubt about it. And there's a zillion ways to do it, obviously. There's a zillion ways to get to the right place. There aren't a whole lot of different right places to be, okay? You know, when it's a moment of truth. You know, when you're trying to get that club down that delivery position, I believe there's a few better ways to do it that we can all have commonalities. I will say that. But, no, I'm not that guy. I watch how they act. I mean, even when I go – because I'm big on watching my kids play, you know, in tournaments. How they act is a bigger deal to me. Body language is huge.
Interesting.
And so I'm looking for body language, and I don't
like what kind of body language. What in particular? Shoulders. Oh, control.
Control.
Okay.
Control. I'm looking for control. That, you know, this is not life or death. I'm focused on doing what I'm supposed to be doing, and if that putt goes out there and lips out, that putt went up there and lipped out. I mean, you did everything you could, and I don't want the, you know, defeating crush like they just, you know.
Control's a good
word.
Their
dog just got run over when they missed the five-footer. I mean, like, it's ridiculous.
Control's an amazing word if you think about Scottie Scheffler's season of 2022 he just had. Would you agree?
No doubt.
That's what you saw?
And confidence.
Right. Yeah.
You know, if you can, you know, that you can steal from a lot of different, you know, sports and things. And if you're going to stay in the sports world, man, martial arts, there's I don't know a lot about it, but I know they have no doubt – yes, sir, the control, the, you know, finding the zen zone and all the stuff. But to think that it's just, you know, when these people talk about, I read it all the time, you know, we're on this instruction piece now, you know, I get to God to not think about anything. I'm like, that's absurd. This is not, you know, like riding a bicycle.
Right.
Okay, I have 14 implements in the bag, and there's a zillion ways I can use all 14 of those implements. Maybe the driver, I don't change much. Okay, I'll give you that. Mm-hmm. Every other club in the bag, I use several ways.
Sure.
So to think that I'm able to go out there, turn it off. What? Turn off your brain? And then it's just going to happen that I can go, ooh, you know, and it'll just happen. I don't buy that. I think you got to figure out how to do it. And what I see missing is great, solitary, focused practice. Too much group stuff going on, you know, and I want to see that kid. I love to see the kid over on the way over in the corner doing his own thing. That's that kid you better watch out for.
That's where you find it.
Yes, sir.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. We are here with three-time All-American Mark Brooks. I've got a story I've got to tell you when we come back on the other side when I was in second grade. So we're going to go back a little bit.
Going back.
This morning, live at UT Golf Club, Carl Mickelson, Bob Ballew with you as always, and this morning joined by Texas legend Mark Brooks. What an awesome morning this has been. Thank you for spending some time with us. We really appreciate it. What made you, as a player, looking at the media and broadcasters, and then being on the other side of it, what changed in your mind about what goes into that from a media perspective? Not that you're grilling players necessarily, but what changed in your mind as a player? Did you go, yeah, this is a little different than I thought it would be?
That's a good question. I would say it wasn't that difficult for me. Again, it's calling, you know, kind of calling it like you see it. I mean, the difficult part is to not, as far, you know, for doing the broadcast part, was not to describe, you know, what you see on the screen. And so you either kind of habitually do that, like radio is different.
Sure.
Then
you have to, because nobody can see.
Yeah, it's a totally different deal. I would see that transition more so. Luckily, I never did radio. Again, it's just, you know, without getting corny, I made sure I didn't dumb it down, you know. I mean, people, you remember who you're talking to. I'm like, yeah, I'm talking to, you know, it's like, I don't want to compare myself to anybody, but it's like, I'm not going to change the language, you know, to speak to someone that's never played golf. So, you know, part of your job is to educate, you know, and hopefully they learn some of the, you know, nuanced language, you know. And, of course, when you're doing majors, you know, our language is policed a little bit. You know, flag stick, no pin, you know, pin sheets, got to be hole location, you know, all that kind of stuff. It gets a little tedious. I'm not a huge fan of some of that. It's like, we're going to be inclusive. We got to be able to call the flag stick, you know, five different things, you know, that are okay.
Right.
And just stuff like that. But players, I had no trouble. I mean, as a player, you know, I got criticized, you know, a bunch of times. To be real honest, it bothered my wife and more than it did me.
Yeah.
Playing, you know, where I grew up, you know, we were taught to have some pretty thick skin. And if you were a good player, you know, growing up when you were a kid, you have to remember a lot of those kids that just, you know, they don't like you, or this guy didn't like you, or you weren't popular. I'm like, no, you're probably not going to be very popular if you're kicking their butt every, you know, day.
Right.
I don't care what sport you're in.
Right.
Your job's, you know, you need to be respectful of people and all that. I always, you know, tell them I'll steal it. You know, it's like, what kind of, if I had a kid, you know, if one of my grandkids wants to play golf, he said, what do you want to develop? I said, I want to develop a humble, supremely confident warrior on the golf course. That's what I want. A humble, supremely confident warrior. That's who I want. That's what I want on my every, I don't care if it's a team sport or individual sport. And so if they're humble, they're going to be respectful. And so anyway, I think that's part of it. Now, I learned some of those lessons early on. We all act bad. We, you know, break clubs. We do all the stuff.
Right.
But we all have a breaking point. But generally speaking, that's where I'd go with that one.
Well, your education as a teacher, you don't know this, but if I was in second grade, it was probably it was around the time 86 there. So I was my dad came to my school. My elementary school, and he pulled me out of school, and I didn't know why, but I was excited. I was like, I get to get out of school early. Who cares? And he took me to Brookhaven Country Club, and you were hosting giving kind of a kid's camp or a kid's, whatever you want to call it. Yeah,
clinic.
Clinic. I don't know if you, I mean, I don't even know if you've probably done a million of these, but there were four guys that were doing this.
Brian Watts, Scott Verplank, Andrew McGee, and myself.
How about that?
How good
was
that?
That's amazing.
Yeah?
I was like, there's no way you're going to remember this. So my dad grew up at Brookhaven Country, or played at Brookhaven Country Club, and played with Scott forever.
Yeah.
And Brian, and became really good friends with Brian. And, so I was at a kids' clinic with you in second grade. And I was telling my parents this week when we were talking about how we were going to get to do this with you. I was like, Dad, do you remember pulling me out of school? He's like, oh, yeah, absolutely. Like, we got to go do the clinic.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
You know, the other thing, you never know where you're going to get something that sticks a long time. I'm talking about, you know, whatever, tip or how to play a certain shot. You never know where it's going to come from. I'll steal this one because we're at UT Golf Club. But where I grew up, we didn't have a bunch of bunkers. We had, like, five bunkers on the golf course. So it was pretty easy to avoid the bunkers. You could play for, like, 2 months and never have a bunker shot. I don't care if it was a wedge. You kind of played around it. So I didn't have a fully developed bunker game until probably, you know, well, until this day. I was playing at Lakeway, and I was playing a back quick nine with Tom Kite, and we got around there to 17, par 5, and it was a Nichols course, so it had flat. The bunker floor of the bunker was flat. Pretty steep face, and then the green kind of ran away from me a little bit. It was 17 to par 5, so on that front portion. So I'm, you know, anyway, I'm hit it in there on the second shot, you know, ran it up in there, and I got this bunker shot. Pretty tough for me. I hit an okay bunker shot for me at the time, and it rolls down across the green into the collar, into the fringe. He pitches, and he goes, you know, like some comment like, that's the best you got. You know, he throws another ball in there. And I proceeded to try 5, 6, 7, 8 times, and I couldn't get the ball to stop on the green from that bunker. Literally couldn't stop it on the green. And he walked in that bunker and proceeded to give me probably a 45-minute bunker lesson. And there's still things from that. That would have been 1981 or 2, probably right there. So y'all can do the math. That's a long time ago. I still remember pieces of that lesson today and use it today. So you never know where your great little tip's going to come from, and so that's why I do this. So it's, you know, share it with the guys.
Yeah. I don't remember much as a kid of, like, I mean, you have little memories here and there, but I vividly remember standing on the range.
I was going a little deeper on that one, but it's just interesting. You know, whatever, it's a putt or whatever. And, you know, luckily, my career spanned. I got to play with Jack Nicklaus in tour events, tons with Lee Trevino. I mean, you know, he's, you know, there's an idol. That would be my idol. I mean, Lee Trevino's the most awesome guy to spend a day with that you could ever imagine. And it's not just the stories. It's all the, you know, it's the witty and wise way he adds his knowledge or shares his knowledge. And that's what our, you know, we're obligated to share, you know, along the way. And, again, when you get all beat up and bruised, you know, sometimes you got a lot of good things to share.
You ever get a word in with him?
Lee, no. This is way different. It's awesome.
It's a different way to play with him talking the whole time, right? It's a different dynamic.
Yeah, but I mean, man, I don't know how to. There's just very few virtuosos that exist in any industry, and he's one of the few.
Yeah.
And we just to be able to watch it still, you know, at 82 or 83, he's young. I mean, this guy's out there every day doing something with a golf club. It's phenomenal. I mean, it's a virtuoso. So it'd be like being able to watch, you know, Mozart do something. I mean, it's phenomenal.
Mark, we cannot thank you enough for spending this morning with us.
It's been amazing.
This has been awesome.
It's a lot of fun.
And you'll get to go on to SoundCloud and listen to this if you're just now joining us. But we're so grateful for your time, and thanks for the stories and the lessons and everything you do for the game of golf.
Well, thank you. No, it's a blast. It's an honor to be able to even, you know, call this, you know, a piece of home here at UT Golf Club and Austin.
Well, thank you. We look forward to doing it again soon. He's Mark Brooks. Carl, we'll do this again next week.
I can't wait for it. This has been a blast.
We think we'll do this again next week, because if Texas plays K-State at 11,
that's true.
We won't do this again next week. We'll have to wait 2 weeks.
Fair point.
And then if they play TCU at 11, we'll have to wait 3 weeks.
We'll be back talking golf soon enough.
Eventually, it'll come back. Big Ugly Tailgate's coming up next. Casey Studdard and Johnny Rogers. Getting you ready for a full day of football. You know, Mark mentioned the TCU-West Virginia game. If you're a Texas fan, you'll be rooting very hard for West Virginia this morning. Hopefully maybe TCU's a little sleepy. Can't get up in Morgantown for it. They burned some couches tonight. We'll see how it goes. But but Casey and Johnny are coming up next with a Big Ugly Tailgate. Carl, look forward to doing this again soon.
I cannot wait. This was a blast. Next time we see you, it'll be just as fun.
All right. Sounds good. It. Thank you, Mark. Carl, as always, everybody that goes into putting this show together, we appreciate you. This was live at UT Golf Club. This was awesome. We got to do this again. This is Playing Through on the Horn. Stay with us. Big Ugly Tailgate's coming up next. He's Carl Mickelson. I'm Bob Ballew. Go out and make a bunch of birdies, everyone.